Now we were looking at last time we were together last year, we were looking at Great Britain in the first third of the 17th century. And under that, we took number one, the beginning of the reign of James the First. We discussed, A, the character of the king. It's nearly 3 weeks since we discussed him, so I want to remind you a little bit about him again now. James the First was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, but he had never seen his mother since he was a small baby. She had fled to England, and there had been for 19 years more or less in confinement until she was finally executed. He was brought up by the Scotch and brought up with the understanding he was to be king. And in his character, there are two different aspects struggling all the time. One of them is his thorough scholarly training and his training in theology. He was very proud of his knowledge of theology, proud of his knowledge of Latin. He could hardly give three sentences without at least four Latin words interspersed among them. He was the greatest writer that ever sat on the throne of England. That's not saying much because his writings were not outstanding. But he wrote more books than any other king of England ever did. The one he was proudest of was the one on the divine right of kings, which he felt was perhaps the most important of the biblical teachings, at least one of the most important. But he had, on the one hand, he had this background of training, and struggling with it was his own desire to be a thoroughgoing king, to rule in the complete power and authority. And so during the years that he was king of Scotland, he had many struggles with the Church of Scotland. And there were times when the church was completely controlled by its ministers and elders. And there were other times when, for a few years, the king had almost complete control over it. But before he became king of England, a few years before, he gave up that struggle, more or less, and acquiesced very graciously in the situation of the Church of Scotland, in which he was the king, the head of the civil government, but the church was controlled by the representatives of his people. And all the time, though, he was, one reason he so graciously agreed to this was because his greatest desire was to become king of England. And he knew he was next in line if only Elizabeth would give the nod, and if only the people would agree to it. Well, Elizabeth didn't until she was on her deathbed. And so he was never quite sure, and he succeeded in making the Roman Catholics in England think that the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, would certainly support them and help them if he became king. He succeeded in making the Puritans think that the man who had been brought up by the Scotch Presbyterians and who knew theology so well would certainly support them and help them. And he managed to make the supporters of Queen Elizabeth feel that he would certainly run the church the way she had run it and would make the church officials and officers supreme in church affairs. So they all were happy to have him come. And he managed to keep them all happy until he got there to England. He was actually, he thought himself a great diplomat, a great handler of people, a great scholar. Actually, he wasn't particularly good in any one of these lines. So his kingship in Scotland and in England was not particularly successful. We wouldn't spend much time on it if it were not that it laid the foundation for tremendously important developments that came later. Now we discussed the character of the king last time, and then we spoke very briefly of the millenary petition. Now this was called the millenary petition, not because it had anything to do with the millennium, but because, like the word millennium, which means thousand years, this meant thousand, and referred to the fact that they said it represented the desires of a thousand ministers. As he was coming into England from Scotland, he was met by petitioners who presented him this petition, which they said had been signed by over 800 and definitely represented, they said, more than 1,000 ministers who desired certain changes in the condition of the Church of England, which would make it a little less like the Roman Church, that it would have a little less of emphasis on ceremony, a little less of emphasis on costume, a little more emphasis on preaching, and certain abuses which were creeping back, which had been there before the Reformation, such as men receiving large incomes from important positions and then not doing much, not even being at their place, that these things be done away with. The king received the petition very graciously and said that he would like to reform the church to make it a church just as it ought to be, with all abuses done away with, and he would like to meet and discuss these things with us. So we come to small c, the Hampton Court Conference. The Hampton Court Conference. On January 14, 1604, in Hampton Court, H-A-M-P-T-O-N, Hampton Court, which was one of the leading palaces of the King of England, which had been one of the leading palaces of the Tudors, who preceded him, James began his meeting that lasted 3 days. But James specified in advance who would be present at the meeting. And here you began to see what his policy was going to be. Because he selected 19 of the top officials of the church to be present. And these high officials were people who had been put in by Queen Elizabeth, people who would carry on the policy that she wanted, which was downgrading the emphasis on preaching, increasing the emphasis on form and ceremony, and greatly stressing the position of the king as the head of the church. There were 19 of them present. And then 4 able scholars were the only representatives of the Puritans who had made the petition. I have a book here by an English clergyman named Wakeman on the church and the Puritans, written from quite a strongly anti-Puritan basis, but written with a very very fine scholarly investigation of materials. He has a great mass of facts in the book and very interestingly presents it. His bias against the Puritan shows on practically every page, but I don't think that it interferes particularly, when one's aware of it, with the value of the book and for the presentation of many very interesting and important facts from this period. And in this book, Wakeman says that though there were only 4 representatives of the Puritans, they were such outstanding men that he's quite sure that if the Puritans had been able to make their own selection of people to be at the meeting, these are the very ones they would have selected. Now, I'm not in a position to make a judgment on that point, but it does, I think, testify that while there were very few representatives, they were very good representatives of the Puritans. Most of the other books I've read on the subject simply point out the great variation between 19 on the one side and 4 on the other, and stress that a good bit. The first day of the conference, the king was very judicious, very dignified. He was, seemed like, the impartial moderator of the session, and as they mentioned various abuses here and there, he expressed his great desire to remedy these. One time he got a little bit heated, and that was when they mentioned that there was considerable disagreement about the Bible in use, because the great mass of the people used the Geneva version, but in the churches the bishop's Bible was the one that was always read, and the bishop's Bible was had many places where they felt a much better translation could be had. And here, the king showed real sympathy with their approach. Of course, he did say he thought the Geneva version was the worst translation that ever had been made. His reason for that was the footnotes and the marginal notes which stressed government of the church by its membership and by its officers rather than by the king. But he did say that he felt it would be a great thing to have a new improved translation, and he would try to take measures, or he would take measures in that direction. But by the second day, everybody there was astonished at the change in the king. And Wakeman even says here, he says he was very calm and judicious his first day, but the second day he ceased to be the moderator and the judge and became the prosecutor and the violent opponent of the Puritans. And when the Puritans expressed their desire that the church be controlled by its officers who were chosen by the people, the king expressed very strongly his feelings. He said, if there's no bishop, there will be no king. He said, if you do not submit to the king, I will harry you out of the land. He said, we will have absolutely nothing of this, he said, in my kingdom. He spoke very, very strongly. And the next 2 days, he spoke so strongly to them that the Archbishop Whitgift, the Archbishop Canterbury, who Elizabeth had put in, who had been there a good many years now, he was just about to retire. He declared that he felt quite sure the king spoke by direct inspiration of the Holy Spirit when he spoke to the Puritans. But the king was very proud of his ability to argue with them. He wasn't like Elizabeth, who would say, this is the law, I'm the queen, this is the thing to do. Although Elizabeth would be more apt to say that privately to her representatives and then make them go out and bear the brunt of it. James loved to argue, and especially if he had a few good Latin phrases that he felt really proved the matter. But the Hampton Court Conference gave the clue to the fact that this was going to be a difficult reign for the Puritans, but James's own weakness and inconsistency prevented it from being a time of Puritan decline. It was a time of great difficulty for the Puritans, but a time in which they kept growing in numbers, growing in strength, and increasing in their scholarship and their leadership and their favor they had with the educated people, with the people of ability and leadership in the country. Still, the great mass of the country was rather of an inept group, not really knowing a great deal or taking any great part, but tending to favor what they were accustomed to have. But by this time, what they were accustomed to have was a church in which the king was supreme and in which the Bible was there, available for them to read, in which there were sermons about the Bible, certain of the Reformation advances most of the people had accepted, except a considerable number of the great nobles who were still quite attached to the Roman Church. Yes, sir?
Would you say that
I would say that the first day he held himself under control and realized that as the king he should take this position and let them discuss it, but he got so heated up over the controversy that he forgot himself. And the second and third day, the 19th didn't have the same, like he did the talking for them. But it showed his real attitude. But as you speak of his whimsical attitude, by that I mean sort of a laziness and a tendency to be moved by little temporary considerations. He, for instance, he would have, through his reign, he would have favors. He would find some man, he might be a prize fighter, almost anybody. He happened to, might be a highly educated man. Somebody would attract the king's fancy, and he would make the man a noble and give him all kinds of positions and money, and everybody else would have to kowtow to him. And there were about three or four like that, one after the other. Most of whom were quite unpopular, but the king gave them just about anything they wanted. And then there was one quite strange thing, that in 1611, when the 1610, I guess it was, when the next archbishop, who was right for the king, died, the king, instead of appointing the man they expected him to, appointed a man who, while very, very loyal to the king, was very, very strong Calvinist. And this meant that during the next 10 years, the king's attitude in the church was sort of blunted all the time. In those 10 years. The last 5 years of James' reign, he just sort of pushed the archbishop aside and paid no attention to him and had made other men act. But that prevented him from being near the force against Puritanism. Well, now, we go on to number two, the King James Bible. The King James Bible. 30 years ago, I don't believe I had More than very few times I've ever heard anybody speak of the King James Bible. Everybody then spoke about our two common Bibles in America, the Authorized Version and the Revised Version. Those were what we spoke of, I guess, even 20 years ago. The Authorized Version and the Revised Version. And everywhere you would find them abbreviated, the AV and the RV. The RV, the Revised Version, was also called the American Standard Version. You'd often see it as ASV. Because actually the Revised Version made in England had been further revised by the American Membership Committee, and that's the one we usually use in America here. Those were the two Bibles. Then the Revised Standard Version was issued, Old Testament, the New Testament first, I believe it's 1946, and then the Old Testament, I think, was 1952, and they made such a big claim that theirs was now the Authorized Version, that people quit calling the King James Version the Authorized Version. I haven't seen anybody in 10 years, of course, whether it's the AV or the Authorized Version. But ever since that date, they all call it the KJV, or the King James Version. Well, that probably is a better name for it, though I rather hate to dignify King James by using his name for such an excellent Bible. But that is the way that it is referred to today. Yes, Mr. Williams? Well, we'll spend quite a little time on that topic. We will discuss that at considerable length. Good question, but I'm not quite ready for it yet. Now, number two, then, will be the King James Bible. As they say, I would have called it the Authorized Version previously, but that term is now not used. Well, now I would like to summarize in somewhat of detail the previous history of the English Bible. So I'm going to put this as a small a under two. The King James Bible, small a, the previous history of the English Bible. This is a subject which we have touched upon in various connections, but I haven't gone very fully into it at any time because I think it is of value to gather it all together and get a picture of the development of the English Bible. And so under this two, we'll put one in parenthesis, and I will call that Bede and Alfred. Capital B-E-D-E. Bede and Alfred. And now the most important of these two is Bede. B-E-D-E. He's generally called the Venerable Bede. He was in the 8th century A.D. As you know, in the early days of the Christian church, it was a great desire wherever the gospel went to get the Bible into the language that the people had there. The church of Rome for two or three centuries was a Greek-speaking church, so they used the Bible in the Greek. But in the places where the Romans were, aside from Rome, and to some extent even in Rome, particularly in North Africa, they began making translations into Latin. And in 400 A.D., St. Jerome made his great translation into Latin for the common or vulgar people, therefore called the Vulgate. And this came to be the great Bible of the Western world, was the Vulgate, St. Jerome's translation into Latin. Ulfilas went from the Roman Empire in the 4th century up in outside the empire among the barbarians, and one of his great desires was to take the Gothic language and reduce it to writing, make a written system for it, and translate the Bible into Gothic. And so he translated the whole Bible into Gothic, except for the books of Kings, because as the Goths were so warlike anyway, he didn't want to encourage them in it by translating Kings, which had so much war. But he translated all the rest of the Bible into Gothic. So when they overran the Roman Empire, they already were Arian Christians as a result of Ulfilas's translation. But then when the Dark Ages came, there were very few people anymore who had opportunity to learn to read and write. And the little bit of learning there was for several centuries was kept alive in the monasteries, and there they used the Latin. And the habit of translation sort of fell into abeyance. Every educated person up until 60 or 70 years ago knew Latin anyway. And I believe 60 or 70 years ago, Princeton Seminary, the theology books were all in Latin. It was up till that time, every scholarly person read Latin all those centuries. But still we find, as early as the 8th century in England, we find a great scholar named the Venerable Bede, B-E-D-E. He was very anxious to translate the Gospel of John into the language of these poor barbarians, these Anglo-Saxons, who had conquered the island of Britain and had been there for nearly 2 centuries by this time. And so, in 735, they say, when he felt that his end was approaching, he was very busy translating the Gospel of John. Ascension Day drew near and his illness increased, but according to the account of a contemporary, he only labored the more diligently. And on the Wednesday, his scribe told him one chapter alone remained, but he feared it would be too painful to him to dictate. "It's easy," Bede said, "take your pen and write quickly." The work was continued for some time. He passed the remainder of the day till evening in holy and cheerful conversation. Then the boy scribe at last found the opportunity to remind him. He said, "One sentence, dear master, still remains unwritten. Write quickly," he answered. The boy soon said, "It is completed now." "Well," Bede replied, "thou hast said the truth. All is ended. Take my head in thy hands. I would sit in the holy place in which I was wont to pray, that so sitting I may call upon my Father." Thereupon, resting upon the floor of his cell, he chanted the Gloria, and his soul immediately passed away while the name of the Holy Spirit was on his lips. Thus we see this early there, this very godly man who was a fine Hebrew and Greek scholar, which was a very rare thing in those days, who was so anxious to get the Gospel of John into the language of these poor barbarians who were settled in England and from whom the country takes its name. It's a little over a century later when there was a famous king of England named Alfred, perhaps the best name of all the Anglo-Saxon kings. And Alfred, while he did not know Greek, was a very good Latin scholar, and he was engaged in a personal effort to translate the Psalms into Anglo-Saxon at the time of his death. And so through those years, there were individuals who made translations. Except for Bede, they were all from the Latin, because knowledge of Greek and Hebrew was very rare. But Bede was a good scholar in addition to being a very godly man. But it was only sections of the Bible that had been put into the language of the people of the country. And of course, there was no printing as yet, so that any distribution would have to be a slow task. So now we look at number two. We jump forward to the 14th century. And number two is Wycliffe. W-Y-C-L-I-F is one way to spell it. Most names back in those days you will find spelled three or four different ways in different books. Spelling was not yet established. It was not yet settled then. It didn't become so until printing made it a more stereotype. And it didn't get finally exactly so until the typewriter. Now we have a great many words fixed in very foolish ways of spelling them. It's very hard to get them changed. But the spelling was very fluid in those days. So you'll find Wycliffe spelled many different ways. I rather like W-Y-C-L-I-F. But John Wycliffe, as you know, was a great Christian who had all the teachings of the Reformation, actually, by the time of his death. He died, about 1382, very close to that anyway, when Wycliffe died. But Wycliffe had a long life as a prominent scholar in Oxford and as a man who had been in important political positions at various times as representative of the king, but whose great desire was to follow the will of God. And the result was that little by little he came further in the Reformation belief until by the time of his death his ideas were almost exactly what Luther and Calvin held 200 years later. But by that time, the leadership of England had pretty well turned against him, which favored him very much in his early years, had then turned against him, and in 1415, at the Council of Constance, he was condemned and his body dug up and burned, and the ashes thrown into the river. But during his life, one of his great desires was to get the Bible so more people would know it. And so he set to work starting with the Revelation, the books of Revelation. He felt exactly fitted his time. He felt the situation was so bad, the coming of the Lord must be very, very near, and he wanted to get the book of Revelation ready, but then he went on translating other parts of the scripture and having other friends working, good scholars working with him in it. And the result was that they got out a translation of the Bible into English, so far as we know, the first complete translation of the Bible into English. And this translation was made from the Latin Vulgate. And Wycliffe sent out his poor priests, as they called them, who would go all through the country reading the Bible to people wherever they could get a group together. And very often two knights would go along with them and stand beside them in armor, ready to protect them in case anyone stopped them from reading the Bible to the people who would come to listen to it. Now this translation of Wycliffe was soon condemned by the church. His translation was condemned, and he himself, as we noticed, was condemned, and the effort was made to stop its distribution. In 1408, there was a convocation of the province of Canterbury at Oxford, and they enacted constitutions against the distribution of Wycliffe's Bible. They said it is a dangerous thing, as witnesses the blessed Saint Jerome, to translate the text of the Holy Scripture out of one tongue into another. For in the translation, the same sense is not always easily kept, as the same Saint Jerome confesses, that although he were inspired, yet oftentimes in this he erred. We therefore decree and ordain that no man hereafter by his own authority translate any text of the Scripture into English or any other tongue by way of a book, pamphlet, or treatise, and that no man read any such book, pamphlet, or treatise now lately composed in the time of John Wycliffe, or since, or hereafter to be set forth in part or in whole, publicly or privately, and so on. And so the stringent efforts were made to stop the distribution of Wycliffe's writings, and they had only the manuscript copies because there was no printing as yet. And yet there was very great interest, and although the great mass of the people in the next century and a half probably had never heard of Wycliffe, yet there were 170 copies that have been preserved to this day of it, now, all made by hand, and mostly made between 1420 and 1450 after the condemnation had been given against it. And these were greatly treasured by the people who had them, and they were, at the time of the Reformation, there was a small group, and yet a very definite group of people scattered throughout England, who the enemies called the Lollards, who were the followers of Wycliffe. They were not a large enough group to have brought any great change in England, but among these people, there was a great influence of Wycliffe's Bible, still effective, nearly 150 years after his death. In 1520, when the... Yes? Today. And of course, they doubtless were many copies burned that they could get a hold of. In 1520, when they began to get possession of printed Bibles, Fox says in his Book of Martyrs, that in 1520, great multitudes tasted and followed the sweetness of God's holy word. He says the fervent zeal of those Christian days seems much superior to these our days and times, as manifestly may appear by their sitting up all night in reading and hearing, also by their expenses and charges of buying of books in English, of whom some gave as much as the equivalent today of $200 for a copy of the Bible. Some gave a load of hay for a few chapters of St. James or St. Paul in English. Fox says, to see their travels, their earnest teaching, their burning zeal, their reading, their watching, their sweet assembly, may make us now in these days a free profession to blush for shame. That's what Fox said after Queen Elizabeth had been queen 5 years in 1562, looking back at the time when they began to bring the Bible in print form into England. And there were, of course, those already who had Wycliffe's manuscript copies. Now, number three is Tyndale. The name Tyndale is spelled in various ways. I think as good as any is T-Y-N-D-A-L-E. But Tyndale, we discussed a little more than we have most of these Bible translators, because he is such an important figure in the development of the Reformation. He was well educated, knew Hebrew, Greek, and Latin very well, and also spoke Italian, Spanish, English, and French very fluently. He was a very excellent linguist, a very earnest Christian, a man who, as a young man, made the great ambition of his life. He said, "If God spare my life ever many years, I will cause that the boy that drives the plow will know more of the Scripture than most of the church leaders do now." That was his ambition made as a young man, and he devoted his life to it. And just about when he was beginning his work, Erasmus' Greek New Testament was published. And of course, this was, all the scholars thought this was a wonderful thing, to have Erasmus' Greek New Testament. It didn't affect the people at large. Erasmus had many footnotes that brought out various aspects of the gospel very clearly. But they were, the footnotes were in Latin, the copy was in Greek, but this helped to stimulate Tyndale to want to put it into the language of the common people and to have an easily accessible copy of the Greek from which he could work. And so he worked from Erasmus's Greek New Testament, and he set to work to decide on the best style in which to put it. And he gave considerable thought to it and decided to try to make a simple, clear style of English that would drive the thoughts home. And it is amazing how well he succeeded in that. A great part of the merit of the King James Version comes from Tyndale, who was dead nearly a century before the King James Version was made. But Tyndale was a very able man, a very consecrated man, and although he engaged in much controversy in his life and wrote many letters and articles on points of theology, it is said that it is interesting to see that though they are very well written, he does not have this excellent style in them that he has in his Bible translation, which he set to work so carefully to make a translation that would give the real flavor and feeling of the original just as accurately as he could get it. And Wycliffe and Tyndale worked through his whole life, worked very, very strenuously to accomplish this purpose. He came to London, where there was a great scholar who was Bishop of London, and asked him to take him into his house and let him work there to make this translation. And the Bishop of London, who was a great mathematician, a great lover of scholarship, felt that this was a revolutionary undertaking, and not only refused to take him into his house, but set to work to try to prevent him from accomplishing his purpose. And he had to flee the country. So he spent the rest of his life on the continent. He had about 15 or more years of life that remained after he left England. And he was in different places on the continent. The enemies of the Reformation would find out what he was doing and would bring efforts against him, try to destroy him. One time in 1525, he was in Cologne. And there in Cologne, he was beginning to print the translation of the New Testament. Cologne is a section of Germany which, during the Reformation time, varied according to its rulers, part of the time being strongly Protestant and part of the time strongly Roman. During quite a period there, the rulers varied from one direction to the other. But Tyndale, for a time, about 1525, was able to work uninterruptedly there, and had 10 sheets of his New Testament printed when one of the strongest enemies of the Reformation, one who had stood against Luther at Worms very strongly, found out what he was doing and got the officials to come to seize the printer and the materials, but word got to Tyndale before the police got there, and he managed to escape with his materials. And he went to Worms. The city of Worms was where 4 years before Luther had stood before the emperor. But now the city of Worms was thoroughly in support of Luther. And for a number of years, Tyndall was able to work there unhindered. And so the great enemy of the Reformation, who had tried to get his work stopped at Cologne, now sent word to England. And he described the books that he was having, that Tyndall was having printed, so that they would be on the watch for them, the authorities would in England, in order to prevent their coming. He sent word to King Henry, to Wolsey, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Bishop Fisher of Rochester, telling them of this terrible peril, that 3,000 copies of the New Testament were being printed for secret distribution through England. He urged them to prevent the importation of this pernicious merchandise. But this warning came to England, and Henry and the leaders of the church set to work, but it was very difficult to prevent their coming into England, because England was already then quite dependent on foreign commerce. The livelihood of England depended largely on the fine wool that was produced there, much of which, a great part of which, was sold to the continent. And so there was constant traffic back and forth, and they managed to bring in a great many copies of this Bible. And Tyndall, hearing that they had been warned, he'd already printed a good many copies in a certain size, he now printed a new edition in a different size. And the result was that they were looking for this one size book, and they caught a great many of them, but the other size they didn't expect. And so many of them got through. And the books were rather widely distributed in England. And another man who was later Archbishop of York was on the continent representing King Henry. And he also found out what Tyndall was doing. And he sent a warning to the king. And he said to the king, he said, there's this effort to bring these Bibles into England. It would be wise to make some means of stopping it. And so eventually they managed to gather a great number of them, and Tunstall, the Bishop of London, preached a great sermon in London, which he said he found 3,000 errors in Tyndall's translation. And Thomas More fiercely attacked the translation as ignorant, dishonest, and heretic. And they gathered all they could for a great bonfire in London. But they made great efforts to stop it, but Tyndall kept on working and got the whole New Testament translated and published in a number of editions, constantly working over them to improve them. And he had translated a substantial part of the Old Testament when he was seized through a spy who got a hold of him and pretended to be a good friend, found his plans, and then got word to the authorities. And so in what is now Belgium, he was imprisoned for some time. And then in 1536, he was taken out and strangled and burned. And his last words were, "God, open the eyes of the King of England." And I don't know whether you can say that King Henry's eyes ever were opened, but you can say that King Henry's attitude was greatly changed. Because already by this time, Henry, in his great desire to have a divorce and to marry Anne Boleyn, had found that his supporters were people in this who urged him to declare himself the head of the king of the church rather than the pope. And these were largely people who were greatly influenced by the teachings of Luther and Luther, and whose teachings the king had been dead against. But the king gave a considerable support to these men and made Cranmer his head of the church and made certain men head of the political government who were strong favorers of the Reformation. And these men were very anxious to have the Bible available. And so the result was that even before Tyndall died, they had secured a half-hearted permission of Henry to allow the Bible to be distributed in England. It's interesting that a little before this time, about 2 years before Tyndall's death, the one of the men who was distributing his books was seized and imprisoned. And a friend got word to Anne Boleyn and asked her to use her influence to get him released, and she did. And she got the man released from prison and spared from the punishments and able to go on with what he was doing. And Tyndale was so pleased with this that he had a special copy of the Bible printed up on very fine paper with a very nice cover and a dedication to Anne, to Queen Anne, which he sent to her and which is today in the British Museum. And so it was fortunate for the Reformation that this woman who Henry took such a tremendous fancy to, perhaps partly because she was not so pliant as the other women that he was attracted to, and she held him off for 6 years before, and sister he married her. Of course, eventually he beheaded her, but along the course of it, she gave great help to the introduction of the distribution of the English Bible. Now, number four is Coverdale. We haven't mentioned Coverdale, or if we have, barely so far. But Coverdale, Coverdale, is not a great genius like Tyndale, not a man who had a heroic life like Tyndale, and yet a man who, next to Tyndale, is perhaps as important in the development of the English Bible as anyone. Coverdale, I've never seen his name spelled any way but that. But Coverdale was a good scholar, not a great scholar like Tyndale. He had great literary ability. He was able to express things very well. And he was a tremendous preacher. And toward the end of his life, they would have thousands of people get it to hear Coverdale's preaching. He was a very earnest Christian and well-trained in Greek and Hebrew. And as a young man, he went to the continent. He sought Tyndale. He probably visited Luther and other Reformation leaders. And he set to work to make a translation of the Bible. Now, King Henry was very bitterly opposed to Tyndale. He knew what Tyndale was doing. He hated him for it. He had seen Tyndale's discussion of various doctrinal points on which Thomas More and Tyndale strongly opposed each other, and the king had stood with Thomas More. And so the very name of Tyndale was anathema to the king. But Cranmer persuaded the king to agree to let Tyndale, the Coverdale translation of the Bible, be distributed in England. And so in 1535, while Tyndale was in prison, Coverdale's translation was brought into England, and while the king never gave it any strong support or anything like that, he simply permitted that it be distributed. And so it was the first translation, printed translation, that was freely distributed without interference by the government. Yes? On the continent. It was translated on the continent. The copies were brought into England. Well, this Coverdale, during his life, at different times, he devoted a considerable amount of attention to the translation of the Bible. And he has the honor of being the first one whose Bible could be distributed without the authority interfering. It's not as great a translation as Tyndale. Then number five is Matthew. And whether Matthew was a real man or imaginary, nobody knows. There is a real man named John Rogers, a man who was later burned at the stake by for his faith. But Rogers prepared a Bible which he issued in the name of Thomas Matthew. And whether this was an unknown fellow laborer or simply an assumed name is not certain. But John Rogers prepared this by simply taking Tyndale's translation of the New Testament and Tyndale's translation of the Old Testament up to 2 Chronicles, which was all that he had available to him, and then taking Coverdale's translation of the rest of the Old Testament and putting them together. And he put them together and had them printed on the continent, and brought them into England with a dedication on them to the Queen, or to the King and to his new Queen, Queen Jane Seymour. And we don't know whether Cranmer knew this was being prepared, but as soon as he found out about it, he wrote to Cromwell, who was the head of the government under Henry, and he told him he had a very fine translation here, better than any translation he'd seen yet, and would he see if he could get the King to approve of it. And of course, nobody told Henry Tingle had anything to do with it. Henry would have condemned it completely if he knew Tingle had anything to do with it. But not knowing that, Henry gave his approval, and the Matthew Bible was circulated in England with the King's permission, without any ecclesiastical decision, but it came to be distributed quite widely, and thus Tyndale's translation came into free circulation, that is, unhindered circulation. That is, all except the last half of the Old Testament, which was taken from Coverdale. Then number six is the Great Bible. The Great Bible. Cromwell was the leader of the government, was very anxious that the Bible be widely circulated. Cranmer was pushing his influence in this direction. And they got the King to get a law passed that every church should put up a Bible in the largest form in the church, in the vestibule of the church, where it could be freely used. And they ordered a couple of the bishops who had been trying to destroy the Bible before as it was distributed to help in the preparation of it. We don't know how much they did about it. Later on, they claimed they hadn't had anything to do with it. But at least their names were used in connection with this Great Bible, which was on the basis of Matthew, but with further comparison of the Hebrew and Latin text than had been made before, and Coverdale had a great deal to do with the preparation of it. And this Great Bible they ordered prepared in Paris. And the King asked the King of France, since they did not have the equipment in England to print a really fine Bible, that he asked the King of France to give permission for the preparation of this Bible for the churches of England in the English language in Paris. There were seven issues of this Bible issued between 1539 and 1541. It was in great, large sheets and very well prepared. But when King Francis gave his permission to it, it was very casually stated. He said that they would be permitted to print this in Paris and to prepare this with the understanding, of course, that nothing heretical shall be done. Well, of course, that statement gave the inquisitor the opportunity to interfere any time he would take an notion to, because he could declare what he thought was heretical. And so word came that the inquisitor was preparing to interfere. And the two Englishmen who were in charge of it managed to escape before the Inquisition got a hold of them. But they came back soon, and they took the presses and the types and the French workmen to London with them. And they hunted around, and they found that a lot of the sheets that had already been printed had been burned, but four great dry vats full had been sold to a tradesman as waste paper. And they managed to get a hold of them and rescue them and take them to England. And this marked the introduction of good printing into England, because they got these expert French workers and this good equipment superior to anything the English had had as yet. So they took them over to England and were able to continue the printing in England. But the Great Bible was now, between 1539 and 1541, was distributed to all the churches in England, and soon the ministers began to complain. They said, the people don't listen to our sermons, they stand around in the vestibule reading the Bible. And they said, when we're trying to hold the service, we'll hear an uproar as the people get into discussing what some verse means out there in the vestibule. And they felt that the introduction of the Bible was a tremendous hindrance to the advance of the church. Well, this was between 1539 and 1541, and very fortunate that it came then. Because although Henry made a proclamation in 1540 urging that people read it, and urging, insisting that every church should have it, it was within those next 2 years that he changed his attitude, reverted largely to the attitude of his early days, and began to really persecute the Protestants as he did for the last 5 years of his reign. And now he began to interfere with the distribution of the Bible, but he did not have the great Bibles taken out of the church. And he gave orders that common people were not to read the Bible, only the learned were to read it, and people worked to hold big discussions over it, and he burned a number of people at the stake, and he interfered with those who denied the superstitious ideas of the Middle Ages, but the Bible was still being circulated. And then when Henry died, Edward VI, so as he, the little boy, was to be crowned. He was 10 years old, but Cranmer had a lot to do with his upbringing. And they said, "Here are three swords," they said, "the sword of the kingdom of England and of Scotland and of Wales, the three great swords that belong to you as king." And the little boy is 10 years old. Whether he thought of it himself or whether it was Cranmer who put the idea in his head, we don't know. But they say at least that he said, "There's a fourth sword that I want that's more important than any of those." He said, "The sword of the Word of God." And they handed him the Bible. And so in Edward VI's reign, there were new efforts of translation and greatly increased distribution of the Bible. And the Bible knowledge took a tremendous step forward in those 6 years before the little boy died and the persecution returned. But we continue there tomorrow. We will not meet this.